this is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
And good evening. Welcome to the second hour of an extended edition of Alt FM, WBAI's weekly lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, two-spirit, queer, and questioning program from a progressive viewpoint that probes the issues that are affecting these marginalized and disenfranchised communities in our metro area and around the country and around the world. I'm Bob Lederer, here with co-hosts Naomi Russell and John Riley. And tonight we have we're continuing, you're about to hear part two of a very exciting interview that I did recently with the author of a powerful new book, 700 plus page book called Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. And ACT UP is an acronym for the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and it's still in existence today. It's a direct action organization that was responsible through massive civil disobedience and rallies and other forms of protests, responsible for major life-saving policy changes against the will, but forced upon the pharmaceutical industry and the federal, state, and city governments that were completely complacent and insensitive to the disease and death of people from a variety of oppressed communities that were subjected to HIV and to AIDS. And this is a really exciting history that we can all learn from, regardless of what we're interested in bringing about change, because there are rich lessons here for every movement for peace and justice in the U.S. and in the world today. And Naomi?
Let me just see. Am I? Yes. Hi. Yes. And I really encourage you to get, take a look at this book. If you go to, a regular bookstore and they have it on the shelf, you can see what a very detailed, complicated book it is and how much information is in it. And this way, you can get it online. If you pledge $75 to WBAI, you can see all of the variety of interviews that were done, the multiple people that were involved in the project that Sarah and Jim Hubbard were doing. And you get a feeling for how much intensity and excitement and commitment was in this group of people. In fact, John and Bob, I know that you were part of that grouping. I came to some meetings because I was an AIDS social worker, and I just wanted to be around people who were really angry, but I didn't have the energy or the time to spend in ACT UP. But you did. I'm wondering, for you, looking at this book or reading the book, what was brought up for you?
Well, I personally found this book absolutely gripping and thoroughly authentic to my experience of 12 years in ACT UP, it really not only made it come alive, but it drew out the most important lessons for organizers. How do you build a successful movement? And we can talk more about that as the hour unfolds, but right now we want to get back to the recording of the interview I did recently with the author, Sarah Shulman, author of Let the Record Show.
You know, you're telling that story about Rebecca Cole and the banning of women from clinical trials brings back memories of a demonstration that very few people talk about anymore, that I went down to Rockville, Maryland, where the Food and Drug Administration had its headquarters. That was my second, many ACT UP people's second time there, because, of course, there was the famous gigantic action in 1988 that quickly led to the speed up of the drug approval process for emergency conditions like AIDS. And it was largely focused on women's lack of access to trials and the refusal to by the FDA to mandate that drugs be tested in women. And that changed, not just from one action, but from a concerted campaign over many years led by the Women's Caucus of ACT UP. And it was really a remarkable experience to be part of such a powerful and strategic movement. And so that actually, although you don't cover that particular demonstration because it falls, I think, just after your focus, which ends in 1993. But in any case, that's one of many, many examples, rich examples of a brilliant process that ACT UP used to bring about life-saving changes, and which you include the flaws within ACT UP as they're trying to make these breakthroughs. And on today's program, we're only going to have time to discuss, unfortunately, a few. But let's start with the one that you already mentioned a couple of times, and that was the movement that fought and in 1993 won an expansion, a significant expansion of the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC's, definition of AIDS to include conditions primarily experienced by poor women with HIV, mostly women of color, and yet had been excluded from both the research, the healthcare, and the financial benefit programs that other people with HIV, primarily men, were able to obtain, although that too took a struggle because it was gay men. So now I'd like to play a clip from the 2017 documentary film called Nothing Without Us, The Women Who Will End AIDS, made by Harriet Hirshhorn.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
The scientists say they are dealing with some new deadly sexually transmitted disease.
The perception early on was that it was a disease that was only affecting gay white men, which was completely and totally inaccurate.
Women were dying faster. Women were sick and still being ostracized and isolated without the benefit of women-specific resources and support.
There was a saying kind of in the early days of the epidemic, women don't get AIDS, we just die from it. That perception continues to be true.
The people who could afford drugs were getting them from Europe and from the US, and it was just ridiculously expensive.
I think because the impact of how this epidemic has hit certain particular groups that are considered
social outcasts.
Racism, classism, sexism, you name it, any of the isms that you can think of.
Mon expérience est partie, je dis, de femme. Je me suis battue parce que ma révolte a été la révolte du maire.
The average person who goes to church believes that they're exempt from HIV. They think they can pray it away. And I am a living testimony that prayer doesn't stop you from becoming infected.
One, two, three, four, five. We are fighting for our life. Six, seven.
In this country, we're almost 30% of this epidemic. Worldwide, we're 50% of the epidemic. Maybe a little more. Yet, what you hear about women is almost zero.
For everything that the men have done to forge the fight on this epidemic, to open the door, it will be the women who close the door on this epidemic. I am not confused about that at all.
Straight, black, white, prison, healthcare,
an ex-prisoner, and I'm also HIV infected, and I learned that status while being confined. And because I want adequate health care for prisoners that I left there, I don't want them harassed or isolated as a result of that. I want them to let out terminally ill individuals, because that's like double jeopardy, and it becomes a death sentence for those individuals. And if they pose no threat to society, let them out and let them die in dignity in hospice or in community that they belong to. And I want.
If you ask me, in my whole life, who are the kind of biggest mentors that I've had, one would be for sure Katrina Haslip. She had been incarcerated at Bedford Hills, which is a women's prison upstate. She not only taught herself the law and became a jailhouse lawyer, she knew all about criminal law, she knew how to file appeals to shorten people's sentences, she knew all there was to know about HIV and policy. So she was an incredible leader at Bedford Hills.
I am affected by this epidemic either as a person with HIV or loving someone who's HIV, so we all are living with it. And I said, well, I'm living with it from another perspective as an infected individual. And people's mouths, like, dropped, you know, because, like, they see me as this Muslim, you know, they see me as, you know, this girl who jogs in the yard all the time, you know. I was the law library clerk, so, no, I was straight, you know, so how did she get infected, you know?
There was a freak out in here. There was fear that was very volatile, you know, lots of rumors. More and more women were coming into the facility with fear. I mean, I think that in those years, that's when everyone said, oh my God, I'm going to prison, I'm going to catch AIDS.
Women were afraid to go and seek help or go and even get tested, because what were you going to do when you found out? And if you went to get tested, then maybe nobody would speak to you.
We knew very little about AIDS. We knew that we would need education from outside resources, and we knew that we would need training ourselves in order to help the PWAs. As a result of that, we were doing counseling, like one-on-one, informally, in the yard, in the shower, you know, wherever, you know, people ask questions.
Reason, but that is not the only reason people
and what,
are in
what
isolation.
About somebody that's HIV positive and they want to go to somebody in isolation that may have cancer or something else?
They've created a group called ACE, AIDS Counseling and Education. It's a very emotional time. We didn't only deal with the women who had HIV, we had to deal with family members. Women were losing family members right and left.
We began to link PWAs up with buddies who would go up to the hospital and see them, who would do their shopping or clean up their cells or help them in the shower or take them out for recreation. And we noticed that it was changing the community, that we seen ourselves as a community. And we were very hyped about it because we felt like we were the community that was invisible, that no one thought could help themselves, and yet we were doing it.
I didn't think she was going to make it past a month. She was so sick.
ACE gave her what she needed, which was a vision of the rest of her life. She had that idea of, I'm going to get out because I have to get out and I have to be a voice for changing the way that the public sees the AIDS epidemic.
I represent the excluded and underrepresented groups of women, minorities, and HIV-positive individuals, and also prisoners, of which I am a member of all of the above. It is important to us that we educate ourselves, that we learn what treatments are available and how effective they are, and that we be given unlimited access to them.
It seemed obvious to us that we were in the middle of an epidemic that had to do with women and children. And so that was kind of our push, and in particular, it was Katrina's push. She said her first goal when she got out was to change the CDC definition of AIDS. And she went out there and she talked to people in the movement about it. I think she helped them prioritize that change. She fired up women who had been active in the movement, but helping their brothers to realize that they had sisters in the epidemic.
HHS, that disaster! Women die, six times faster! HHS, that disaster! Women die!
Katrina, more than anybody, is the one first raised these issues in a policy context. I first met Katrina on October 1st, which was 1990. Somebody pulled me over and said, I know you've been waiting to meet Katrina Haslip. This is Katrina. And Katrina laughed and said she was on parole. She wasn't supposed to be here. And, of course, then promptly joined the demonstration. It was shocking to see these women so ill and unable to qualify for anything.
And again, that's a clip from the film Nothing Without Us, The Women Who Will End AIDS by Harriet Hirshhorn. Sarah Schulman, in your book, you write, quote, it is very unusual for movements or groups that are dominated by men and white people to achieve transformational victories that improve the lives of women, people of color, and poor people. And certainly the fact that ACT UP did this stands in great contrast to the history of white gay rights politics, which has led to race and class-based reconciliation with the state. And you later write, quote, despite profound racism and sexism, ACT UP managed to win what I and many others consider to be the most significant victory for women, people of color, and poor people in the history of American HIV, which was when ACT UP's four-year multifaceted campaign succeeded in changing the Centers for Disease Control's official definition of what symptoms constituted AIDS. How this happened is worthy information for women and people of color working coalition today. Because of ACT UP's patient-centered politics learned from feminism, people with AIDS were the experts, and the experiences of women with HIV and people of color, of poor people and healthcare providers in ACT UP, and in coalition with ACT UP, were the basis for campaigns and analysis. So, Sarah, talk to us more about this highly successful life-saving campaign led by the ACT UP Women's Caucus and the critical role played by the woman whose voice you heard just now, the formerly incarcerated Katrina Haslip, who I might note I was pleased to work with personally for several months after her release as a co-host on the AIDS program here on WBAI Radio.
Okay, so an ACT UP member named Risa Denenberg was a nurse in the Bronx, and she had a large number of HIV-positive women as her patients. And she saw that they were getting very, very extreme vaginal infections that were not responding to treatment or that would reoccur at a rate that didn't make any sense. And she brought this information to ACT UP. Simultaneously, a young lesbian poverty lawyer named Terry McGovern, who I think was 28 or 29, had been representing people, very poor people, who were dying of AIDS but could never qualify for an AIDS diagnosis, so they could never get benefits or Social Security. And she couldn't figure out why. And she came to a meeting of ACT UP to report on that information the same night that Risa was reporting on her medical information. And the two of them and the Women's Caucus basically realized that the definition, the official definition of AIDS that you had to meet to get an official diagnosis, was only based on symptoms that men could get, and that the symptoms that women got were not on the list. So that women with AIDS were literally dying without ever getting a diagnosis and could never qualify for benefits and could never get into trials. And so they started a campaign to try to get the definition to change. Now, we have to look back at that time. This was a time when the government was basically white and male. The media was basically white and male, and the private sector was basically white and male. Even me, you know, a white lesbian, there was even no one who looked like me in the government. There was no out white lesbian anywhere in any of these, this power apparatus. It was very, very gendered and very, very racialized. And it's interesting when you compare the experiences of different constituencies inside ACT UP in trying to deal with the power apparatus. You know, famously, Larry Kramer had gone to Yale with the head of Bristol-Myers Pharmaceutical Company, and he was able to get a meeting where he could bring other men from ACT UP who were also very elite, who had gone to Ivy League schools and this kind of thing, and they would sit down with the scientists who were from the same backgrounds, and even somebody reported that occasionally there would be a catered lunch served, right? Well, when the women with AIDS were trying to make a change, they didn't get any catered lunch. It took them 2 years before they could even get a meeting with Fauci. It was so hard for them to get anywhere. And they had to use really different tactics. You know, this kind of like respectability politics of insider negotiating, where you present empirical evidence and the scientists are objective and you're objective and you all are from the same background and you're able to make steps forward, that was not available to women with AIDS. So they...
Let me just point out to those who missed it that Sarah's referring to Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was then and still is today the director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, which was in charge of HIV and AIDS research at the time.
And I'm going to get back to him as well.
Yes, absolutely. Because he's not the hero he's being made out by the corporate media. But go ahead. Sorry.
So the women had to do tactics that the most elite men in ACT UP also sometimes used, but sometimes didn't need. So they would like scream at government officials in airports. At one point, they handcuffed themselves to other people in a meeting. They broke into people's offices and put things in their files. You know, they were desperate, and they had to use really messy tactics. And finally, they did win. Terry, at age 29, sued Social Security, and they did win after 4 years. But one of the really most important leaders of that movement, Katrina Haslip, died before the victory. And she was an incarcerated black straight woman who had found out when she was in prison that she was HIV positive. She became an organizer inside prison. Now, this was at Bedford Hills Women's Prison. And interestingly, there were two women from the Weather Underground who were incarcerated there, Kathy Boudin and Judy Clark. And they were involved also with HIV-positive prisoners in organizing something called ACE, AIDS Counseling and Education. It was a prisoner-based AIDS activist organization because prisoners with AIDS were being treated horribly. People's cells were being trashed or set on fire. People didn't want to. People would beat up people with AIDS. There was a lot of misunderstanding. And so this organization started inside Bedford Hills. Now, when women got out of prison, when their terms were up, many people came to ACT UP. And also then once they were outside, they started an organization called ACE Out. That was the branch of ACE for people who had been discharged. So people like Marina Alvarez and Carmen Royster and Katrina Haslip became AIDS activists and worked closely with ACT UP and many other organizations. But what happened with Katrina is that she died because Terry McGovern reported this in her interview, she couldn't qualify for benefits and she didn't have home care and she kept falling at home. And this exacerbated her illness and she died right before they won a change in the definition. But just to not only when the definition changed did hundreds of thousands of people suddenly qualify, but it's one of ACT UP's most far-reaching victories because today any woman with HIV in the world who takes a medication is taking something that was tested ultimately on women because of these breakthroughs that were won by women with HIV working.
And again, that was my interview recently with the acclaimed book author, Sarah Schulman, who's a journalist, an author, a person of many talents, author of the new and groundbreaking book called Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. And tonight on OutFM, we're asking for your financial support so that we can continue this listener-sponsored station that provides you this kind of hard-hitting coverage and the voices that you are not going to hear on corporate media or even on National Public Radio or Channel 13. These are the voices of people who are really down and out, who've been given the shaft by society in many different ways. People like Katrina Haslip, who This station, as an example of the values of WBAI, opened its doors to welcome her upon her release from prison in 1991 to become a producer of, at that time, a program I was working on concerning HIV and AIDS, in order to bring her wisdom and her very clear view of activism to the microphones of WBAI. So that's the kind of station we are, and that's why we can't and refuse to go to corporate sponsors like the other networks. We need you, the listeners, to give us that support to keep this information flowing. So for a donation of $75, you will get a copy of the ebook, the electronic version of Let the Record Show. All 737 pages of it will be yours to share with friends, to educate, to talk about by calling 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950, or on the web, go to the website, give the number 2WBAI.org, give to WBAI.org, or if it's easier, just go directly to WBAI.org. That's our general website. And you'll find the link in the upper right corner to that donation website. Naomi?
And again,
John, go ahead.
And again, when you click on the donate button on the WBAI website, you'll immediately see that you're on the donation page, and there'll be another donate button. Click on that too, and that will take you to where you can do shopping for your premium, which allows you to become a member. You and another member of your household, or two members of your household, because it's a $75 donation. And so that allows up to three memberships, and you can still get your premium. So, and then from there, you can go on and just fill out your credit card or bank card information and make the purchase. So it's pretty quick once you get over that first step, which is slightly confusing to have to press the donate button twice, but it's worth it. It's a great read. It's a wonderful book. There's a lot to be learned. 212-209-2950 is the number to call if that's easier for you. 212-209-2950.
It's hearing these names, like Karen Timor and Terry McGovern and some of the women that are being mentioned. I recall being a hospital-based AIDS social worker, and what the impact of the ACT UP campaign was on actual people, because I could help people to apply for, I could help women, for example, to apply to get Social Security disability or SSI benefits, because they now qualified, even though they had not qualified before, because now the definition of AIDS had changed and they could qualify for certain benefits. And that was a life-changing thing on an individual basis and also on a mass basis. It made a huge difference what ACT UP was able to achieve. And those people are still active. You know, those people are, they haven't given, this is 30 years ago, they're still active, because, and so are we. You know, that, and so are many of the people listening to this program right now and who listen to WBAI. You were around in the old days and you're still around and you haven't given up. And part of your, what you can do is to keep this kind of information on the air, this kind of analysis on the air, and become a member of WBAI. You don't have to buy the book, although you'd be lucky if you can do it. But you can become a member. You can make this station stronger in the sense that it has financial stability, and you can keep this kind of analysis and perspective and political activism on the air, because you will not get it anywhere else, and not in the New York City area. This is where you're going to get it. So please call WBAI, The number is 212-209-2950 to make a pledge to become a member. Becoming a member, which means putting in $25, will give you the ability to vote in our elections, vote on the various referenda that may or may not appear in the next years. It gives you an input into what you into what this station is going to be and whether this station survives. So here's your chance. Also, you can go to give to the number. This is online. Give to WBAI.org, and you'll see all kinds of other things that you can get, including the Sarah Shulman book that can you can get for making a pledge.
And that book title again is Let the Record Show. And if you just put let the in, it will show up. Also, her name is Shulman,
S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, 212-209-2950. That's essential information, of course, for getting that as a premium.
And you're listening to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI, Pacifica Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM. This is an extended edition of Out FM, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, two-spirit, and queer and questioning program every week from 8 to 9 p.m. I'm Bob Lederer here co-hosting tonight with Naomi Brussel and John Riley. And we're going to be continuing until 9 o'clock. So now we're going to go back to the interview I did recently with the author of Let the Record Show, Sarah Shulman, an acclaimed author. This is her, I believe, her 10th book. She's really a remarkable literary figure. And it was a privilege to be able to interview her about her time in ACT UP and, of course, the 200 plus people she interviewed who were her comrades in ACT UP in those early years. So we're going to go back to the recording right now.
Handed in this manuscript, it was before COVID. And so it was before the second coming of Anthony Fauci. And I really believe that it's because Larry Kramer died and that they had to replace him with another white male hero who everyone could say that he was the savior of AIDS. I recently was watching the Rachel Maddow show and she was saying, it was Anthony Fauci, he did it. He was the person who changed AIDS, you know, because America always pretends that it's some white man who changed everything. But actually, without thinking about him, just writing down what people said, I had so much evidence that when different constituencies in ACT UP went to Fauci with innovative ideas, he would say no. So, for example, Richard Elovich, who was a very important leader in the movement to make needle exchange legal in New York City, he confronted Fauci directly because drug users were not being enrolled in experimental drug trials. And Fauci said, well, they're not reliable. And Richard said, no, you cannot write off an entire class of people. Linda Meredith, who was one of the activists for women with HIV, by the time 2 years had passed and they finally forced Fauci to have a meeting, he didn't want to hear anything about women. He didn't really believe that it was relevant. And he certainly didn't know anything about women with HIV. When the FDA was too slow and there was too much red tape and people with AIDS couldn't access new drugs, Jim Igo, a very important treatment leader in ACT UP, designed something called Parallel Track. It was a system by which people could access these drugs. He sent the proposal to Fauci, who never answered. And 3 months later, Jim had to go to one of Fauci's public speeches and confront him publicly to get him to respond. So, you know, he basically had to be forced to come along. And when Jim and I started the ACT UP Oral History Project, we were invited to the NIH to present our work. And it was very strange because, of course, we had both been at the huge ACT UP demonstration against the NIH when they wouldn't let us in and we were screaming outside and people who were very sick were out there and people were arrested. And here we were invited in to give a talk. You know, and so we showed our materials, and this one woman said, oh, we're so grateful here that Dr. Fauci had the leadership and the insight to know that people with AIDS should have a place at the table. And we were like, that's not what happened. He was forced, you know. So that's, you know, as Dr. King made clear, and as all of us who have been in progressive politics know, people in power never voluntarily give up their power. There is a myth of the benevolent dominant culture, but it's a myth. They have to be forced to change, and Fauci's one of those cases.
That's absolutely right. And you actually have another interesting anecdote in your book about Fauci being confronted by another member of ACT UP named George Carter, who was part of the Alternative Treatments Committee. And there was a conference about scientific developments about AIDS. And George directly asked him, well, what about testing some of the herbs and vitamins that have shown some real promise in some preliminary studies? And Fauci basically blew him off. And that evoked memories of what had happened to me when I had been one of the co-founders of the Alternative and Holistic Treatment Committee of ACT UP in 1988. And as a result of some pressure around the International AIDS Conference held in San Francisco in 1990, at the last minute, I was added to a big community forum, about 700, 800 people, about issues that the community was really worried about. And one of those was the large scale experimentation and buyers clubs for alternative treatments for vitamins, herbs, amino acids, a whole range of options that were helping a lot of people. And I directly confronted Fauci. I was on the panel with him. And one of the audience members, actually an indigenous woman with the Center for Natural Medicine, said, what studies have you done on Chinese herbs and other herbs for HIV? And at this point, this is 1990, there were already numerous studies coming out of China, out of parts of the U.S., small clinics. And Fauci essentially said, there's just no science there. And we have to operate based on science, not on folklore. And so I insisted and got the permission to regain the mic and said, I have to respond to Dr. Fauci's distortions, because that's not true, that this is not a question of a lack of good science. There is good science, but there are bullheaded attitudes among many of the scientists at NIH that they don't consider herbology or nutrition to be a valid form of evidentiary information that should be used to determine what's worth being studied. So that's my Fauci story.
Well, in my book, I have two different photos that relate to Fauci. One is an active demonstration where someone's holding a sign up that says, Fauci, you're killing us. And then the second one is when he finally came to the center and met with ACT UP. And it's a great picture. It's like Mark Harrington and Peter Staley and David Barr and Suzanne Phillips and all of these people meeting with Fauci and his then assistant Peggy Hamburg, who later became the health commissioner of New York. But yes, he was forced.
Indeed. Well, let's move on now. Sarah Shulman, I'd like to talk to you about the important strategic leadership, not only of the campaign to change the definition by the Centers for Disease Control of AIDS, which tremendously opened the door to tremendously helped many, many women around the world with HIV, as you so clearly explained in part one of this interview. And not only was she a leader of the Women's Caucus, but also of ACT UP overall, ACT UP New York overall. And that is the longtime feminist, lesbian rights, reproductive rights, and leftist activist Maxine Wolf. And in your book, Let the Record Show, Sarah, you write, quote, Maxine observed that the left would do their organizing around existing groups. They would ask for endorsements from other organizations that they were already in relationship with. And Maxine said, quote, it was not about people, it was about coalitions. Maxine saw organizations claimed to represent more people than they had actually activated. Coalitions would produce flyers with many organizational names listed as endorsers, but very few people would actually show up. And these are Maxine's words, because there was no membership in the sense that eventually something like ACT UP would have membership. And there was no way to construct a membership for these other groups she's talking about. Because unlike unions and stuff like that, people were not organizing unorganized people. That's a very key concept. Organizing unorganized people. So, Sarah, talk about this concept as it applied to ACT UP and ACT UP and Maxine's important contributions to the organization.
Okay, so, you know, Maxine and I first met because we were in the reproductive rights group, movement together, and we were an organization called CARASA, the Committee for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse, which was founded in 1979 after the Hyde Amendment was passed. So just to give people a little background, abortion became legal in New York City in 1971, and the Supreme Court Roe v. Wade case was 1973. And from 73 to 79, you could get your abortion paid for by Medicaid. But then there was the Hyde Amendment in 79, and which the Supreme Court upheld, and that ended federal funding for abortion. So after that, there were only seven states where if you couldn't afford an abortion, you could get it covered. And since then, abortion has not really truly been accessible and available in the United States since the Hyde Amendment. And that's when the reproductive rights movement really got going. Because prior to that, there had been single-issue abortion rights groups, but people had, and there was a single-issue anti-sterilization abuse group called CESA that wrote the regulations for New York City about sterilization, but they hadn't come together. So we were all in that organization, and it was mostly women from the left, either from left groups or socialist feminists, which was a large contingent at the time. But there was a lot of homophobia in that movement, a tremendous amount. And Maxine, at that time, identified as bisexual. Stephanie Roth, who was the staff person for CARASA, came out as a lesbian. And there started to be more lesbian presence in the movement, and the homophobia really got triggered, especially because we started a lesbian rights committee, and we started to talk about how to organize lesbians. And this is where Maxine's theory comes in of organizing the unorganized. If your idea is to do workplace organizing, which was something that the left always loved because it was on the model of union organizing, that's the worst way to get lesbians activated because people couldn't be out on their job. If you were trying to organize through churches, same problem. The society was so homophobic that only connecting with pre-existing institutions was not a way that you could get reach lesbians for your movements because people were afraid and were excluded. So you had to find a way to get women into your movement without having to go through them already being belonging to other organizations. And it was a fundamental of lesbian organizing. After ACT UP, Maxine and I and three other women started the Lesbian Avengers in 1992. And that was about organizing unorganized women, you know. And that also, that organization also grew very quickly, like ACT UP. There were at one point 22 chapters on four continents. So Maxine really had this very grassroots, non-ideological idea about bringing people in. And ACT UP was an organization that organized unorganized people. Many of the people who came to ACT UP did not belong to anything else. They were not already part of political movements. They did not belong to organizations. They came as this amorphous entity called the community. And community is something that cannot be curated, and it cannot have entry requirements. It's just a way of being that is collective in which everyone is welcome. You know, one of the interesting things in ACT UP is that nobody was ever thrown out. And when I tell that to people today, they can't believe it because there's so much punitive behavior in progressive movements now. You know, if you say the wrong thing, or, you know, if you reveal yourself to be a conflicted person, you can be excluded and you can be labeled toxic and all this kind of stuff. But in ACT UP, there was a political party called the New Alliance Party that tried to take over ACT UP, and they were asked to leave because they were not participating in good faith. But no matter where people were at, they were never kicked out because it was a community. And people didn't have this kind of supremacy ideology about themselves, that they were clean and pure and other people had to be separated. So Maxine really was a community-oriented person. And she started the Women's Committee by having dyke dinners at her home, where, you know, lesbians who came to ACT UP, it was harder for women to get integrated into the organization than for men. And she would have people over for dinner, and people would talk, and she would give people things to read. And in the book, I really parallel her with Mark Harrington. I think that Maxine and Mark were really they were the most identified leaders of the organization. One of the things about ACT UP is that people didn't know each other's last names, and they didn't know what each other did for a living. But everybody knew Maxine Wolf and Mark Harrington, and they were very polarizing figures also. They could be ruthless. They could be cold. But they also created communities around them and gave people things to read and helped people develop their politics. And they had very different politics. Maxine came from the left. She had been politicized as a child by the daughter of someone from the Communist Party who moved in next door. Her father was a cab driver. Mark had gone to Harvard. He had not been politically active until he himself was implicated. So when Maxine came to ACT UP, she was really looking for a movement. And as Marissa Cardinale said to me, AIDS for Maxine was a movement and AIDS for Mark was a puzzle. And ultimately, when the group fractured, it did fracture around their affects, let's put it that way. It wasn't really that they were against each other, but the group polarized around.
You're muted.
And again, that was my interview, just a clip from my interview recently with the renowned author, playwright, novelist, screenwriter, and AIDS historian, Sarah Schulman, author of the 737-page book, Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993, based on over 200 interviews done by Maxine and her project partner, Jim Hubbard. And by the way, if you want to
done by Sarah and Jim Hubbard.
Oh, so sorry. Yeah, I'm confusing my names here. And if you want to read some of those interviews, you can go to actuporalhistory.org. And there's transcripts and also some audio of some of those interviews. But what we're offering tonight as a way to keep this listener-sponsored community radio station, WBAI, on the air is an ebook of Sarah's remarkable work, Let the Record Show. And that's yours for a donation of $75. You can use your credit card or by electronic withdrawal from your bank account, whatever method you'd like. By going to our pledge line, 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Or on the web, go to give2wbai.org. Give2wbai.org for a $75 donation. You will be able to get this remarkable book. And there's so much more than what you've heard tonight that she covers that will just bring you, it brought me to tears with just the bravery, the creativity, the brilliance that ACT UP and all the movements that it pulled together that were already out there doing good work, but kind of made them a force, a fierce force for social change that saved thousands and ultimately in the years after the book covers by the early 2000s, saved millions of lives around the world of people living with HIV who were able to survive with affordable drugs. So please show your support for WBAI, for the ability to hear these kind of voices that are excluded by the corporate media and even the films the highly financed films about ACT UP exclude these voices. But here on WBAI, you will always hear the voices that are not heard elsewhere. 212-209-2950. Naomi?
I asked you earlier what reaction you had, you and John, to, because you were activists in ACT UP, to reading the book, to talking to Sarah. What was the main thing that or some of the main things that it brought back for you?
John, do you want to take a stab at that? And then I'll chime in.
ACT UP is just, it was a remarkable human organism that had so many tentacles. When she talked about how the people spread out into different areas of work, there was a contact sheet, a list of all the committees. There were like 50 committees that were in ACT UP. Nobody could possibly be on all 50 of those committees because they would be doing nothing else but ACT UP work. And these were all hardworking people. And so, and they would be focused sometimes around ongoing groups that would address, you know, like treatment issues. And there would be others that would be around a specific campaign, for example, the exclusion of Haitian people from entering the U.S. Based on HIV positivity. So there'd be a campaign to stop that. Right. And that was very successful in the end. Of course, the government's policy caused a lot of suffering, but, you know, people came together and people in ACT UP worked with people in the Haitian community in order to have mass marches and conduct a powerful campaign. And there were, I was on like half a dozen of these committees over time, ranging from an AIDS cure project, grouping that was trying to fund sort of a Manhattan style project to end AIDS, to working on issues around needle exchange. And, you know, the ACT UP was really groundbreaking in the way it did things. And it was of the left, but not a particular brand of left. And really sought to make policy from what the facts were and everybody was united around the one goal of ending the AIDS crisis. And so tremendous experience, and you can learn more about it. I think it really can inform other social movements. For example, there was a series of civil disobedience actions that Bob and I were a part of around Mumia that was inspired by our work in ACT UP, and that we worked with people in resistance in Brooklyn and a number of other groups, individuals ranging, you know, I won't say the names because there were hundreds involved, but this is this informed our politics. And so we protested at the Liberty Bell, 100 people, mass civil disobedience. We protested at the Supreme Court, 200 people, mass civil disobedience. We protested in San Francisco, and this was a solidarity protest with our Supreme Court protest, 150 people. We invaded Philadelphia, in 2004 for the Republican National Convention, and it was 2000. Yeah. Anyway, it's an amazing book, and the tactics can, to some extent, be transplanted to other movements. Not completely, it's certainly worth considering.
And I want to just note that John Riley, who you've just been listening to, is a 30-year continual member of ACT UP, and he's still a member to this day, and really has provided central leadership in much the same way that Sarah describes in the book about the role of people who came to ACT UP from prior progressive activist backgrounds, and they brought those experiences to bear in really focusing their own minds and then bringing it outward to the group about how we can learn from the lessons, both the strengths and the weaknesses of parts of the left, to make a successful campaign, to change the death-dealing reality of the society towards people either living with HIV or at risk of it. And John became a leader. Sarah closes, you'll recall her, or at least the clip you heard, she closed talking about the very painful split in 1992 within ACT UP. And I'm not going to get into that right now, but let's just say that a lot of people got disillusioned and left ACT UP, and it became much smaller. And then with the advent of the Clinton administration, mouthing a lot of the rhetoric that ACT UP had urged the federal government to take seriously, they finally started talking that way and yet not acting. And during that period, the bleakest times of ACT UP, John was really an important leader, and I just wanted to give him his due for that. But we're going to have to wrap up
time.
Yeah, we are.
You must get this book. You must go to your phone.
Absolutely.
You must call 209-209-2950. You must go to your computer. You must go to give2wbai.org, because it's also partly your responsibility to be an activist. And part of being an activist is supporting the organizations that bring you the important news, the important information, and that's WBAI is one of those. So thank you. We should say goodnight.
Yes, so this has been Out FM with Bob Lederer, Naomi Brussel, and John Riley. And tune in again next week at 8 p.m. And please keep those donations coming in to 212-209-2950. And we'd like to thank the engineers on staff at WBAI for bringing the technical side of the broadcast to you tonight.
Reggie and
also Sarah Shulman.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sarah, very much for a wonderful interview. And so that's it for tonight. So until next time, stay strong, stay proud. Good night.
We are in this together. 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 We are in this together.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th, in New York City, come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots from Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen. We're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. RisingTogether.info for more information.
Our 2021 election is getting underway. Listener democracy keeps our station connected to the people and accountable to you and listeners just like you. Look for your ballot in your email box from Simply Voting or a bright blue postcard. If you need a replacement ballot, visit elections.pacifica.org and file a ballot request form. Call 510-993-0320 if you need a paper ballot.